Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettina, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dan's Talks. My guest today is Lee Minitry, real estate agent for Saunders Real Estate, who specializes in commercial buildings, although I think he'll take mansions whenever that comes around as well.
I'll sell anything.
Well, one of the things I noticed, because I've done two transactions with you and as my rep, and you're wonderful.
Thank you.
I noticed is you do a lot of babysitting, and which we'll get back to, I guess. And number two is the prices for a real estate property that's are typically lower than the same acreage or, you know, land that you would see in a residential property. And I wondered why that was, unless you think I'm wrong.
I mean, you're talking about similar size pieces being priced differently. It all depends on the location, where it is. You know, I mean, they're different commercial zones. Lots of people think it's just commercial or residential, but there are many different commercial zones in the towns. For example, there's commercial industrial in East Hampton, which is known as light industrial in Southampton Town. Those are for like warehouses and things like that versus, you know, village business, which would be for retail spaces. There's highway business. There's neighborhood business. There's office districts. So there's a lot of different commercial zones as there are different residential zones. Residential zones are basically, you know, you can build a house, but it's like 20, 40, you know, you need a minimum of 20,000 square feet or a minimum of 40,000 square feet. So there's different zonings for each property, but, you know, pricing, you know, depends on location. You can have, you know, a commercial industrial piece that's way out in Springs versus, you know, a commercial industrial space piece that, say, is closer to town would obviously be more valuable than the one out way out in Springs further from the village.
But nothing commercial, at least in terms of individual properties, rises to the heights that you see for residential mansions that I can tell. Is that true?
Well, look at the corner in East Hampton. That's probably the closest thing that, you know, Tahari used to own. And now, you know, the big one of the richest men in the world owns. And he paid, you know, I think $24 million for a 7,500 square foot store on the corner, obviously, of Main Street, Newtown Lane. That's the prime location. But, you know, you're talking, you know, mansions going for $100 million, but they're, you know, much larger, 20,000 square feet on, you know, a huge, you know, 3 or 4 acre lot. So, I mean, they're the biggest probably out here commercial sale was the Montauk Yacht Club, I think around 150 million. They're few and far between. There's certainly more mansions than there are, you know, trophy commercial properties.
What attracted you to sell primarily commercial for Saunders?
It just kind of morphed into that. You get pegged for something. As you know, I started out working at the East Hampton Star selling advertising. You know, I was young and I was trying to buy a piece of land, so I had multiple jobs. I managed the advertising for Alan Schneider. And then I had my sales license, which I sold part-time. And then I worked for Loaves and Fishes as a bartender catering on the weekends. So I was working four jobs, and I then started the independent. So I had a relationship with the business community. I did a lot of residential, you know, rentals and some sales at starting out, as most people do. And then it kind of morphed into, once I did a really big commercial sale in like 2007 and 2008, I really kind of got pegged as the commercial guy, you know, for better or for worse. But, you know, I still sell some residential stuff, but it's probably 80% to 20%, you know, 80% commercial. So my relationship with the business community made it easy for me to, you know, start selling restaurants, because I had known all the restaurant people by trying to sell them advertising and stuff when I was in the newspaper business.
Are you a local boy, or did you move out here?
I moved out here when I was 12 years old. I was born in Poplar Bluff, Missouri, which is in southern Missouri, near the Boot Heel, near the Arkansas border. I lived in Iowa, Columbia, Missouri, Memphis, Tennessee, St. Louis, Missouri, Houston, Texas, and then England before I ended up out here. I went to sixth grade in Sag Harbor, seventh and eighth grade in Amagansett, East Hampton High School, went away to college, came back, met a local girl, married her, and that's the story. So I've been out here for over 50 years.
Well, this is a guess, but was your early experience as a boy from military? People move
around? No, my father was a college professor. He taught creative writing. So when I was at Iowa, he was at the Iowa Writers Workshop there. He went to Vanderbilt. I was born, you know, right around when he was graduating Vanderbilt. And then he went to Iowa to get his master's at the Iowa Writers Workshop. And his first teaching job, it was the University of Missouri, Columbia, Missouri. Then he taught creative writing and English at Memphis State. And then when we were in St. Louis, he taught at Lindenwood College in St. Charles, Missouri, over the river. And then he decided to write a biography of a famous heart surgeon named Denton Cooley. So we lived in Houston while he was doing some research. He went to finish the book. We lived in England in Bodmin, Cornwall, in the middle of nowhere, so he could finish the book. We came back from England. He visited a friend at Southampton College who was an English professor there, decided he didn't want to teach anymore, and he was a freelance writer. So he was based out of here and would go to New York to see his editors and publishers and did a lot of international stuff.
Did you have a lot of friends growing up? Was that because you kept moving around?
No. I made friends each place I went, but I always told my kids, you know, be nice to the new kids in school, because as you can see, I went to probably in between first grade and eighth grade, probably five different schools at least, you know. So, you know, I don't have a lot of friends when I was that young, but I certainly have, you know, made great friends since I've been here and still, you know, have a lot of them around, luckily.
What do you like about the Hamptons?
The beaches, you know, the normal stuff. I live out in the woods. I can take my dogs out in the woods and, you know, go for a walk. You know, it's conveniently located to New York City, which was good when I was younger. You know, I don't go as much anymore, you know, see sporting events or, you know, go to the city to do stuff. You know, it's obviously a lot to do there. You know, I do miss some things about the South, namely the barbecue. When I first moved out here, I had to go to Riverhead to go to Spicy's to get barbecue. But then we finally got some barbecue spots out here. I don't know if you remember Turtle Crossing. And now there's Town Line and, of course, Smoking Wolf. So when I was first out here, though, I needed to get my barbecue fix. I'd have to go to Riverhead.
So I mentioned at the beginning that there was a lot of babysitting involved in commercial real estate, but maybe it's throughout, would you think? And if so...
Yeah, I think so. Unfortunately, you know, most people think their property is worth more than it is, you know, so you have to try and, you know, bring them to reality. You know, it really doesn't matter what you think your property's worth or what I think it's worth. The market's going to tell you what it's worth. So eventually, you know, people will hopefully listen to that. You know, you work on both sides, you know, you work for sellers and buyers. So, you know, you're on both sides of it and see both points of view. But obviously, this is a great place to sell real estate because, you know, it's pretty expensive commercially too, but certainly residential, it's up there in the tops in the country, is evidenced by, you know, several of the zip codes being in the top 10 in the country as far as most expensive real estate.
What's the most interesting sale you've had since you started in real estate? I guess now it's about 15 years.
It's been about 40 years. Most interesting. Well, I'll tell you, the most interesting listing I had was the Andy Warhol estate. I first listed that, I don't know, way before it was sold. I was working with Paul Morrissey, who was Warhol's partner after he died. And I think the listing price then was $50 million. And, you know, I told him it was worth, you know, mid to low 20s. And, you know, it sold probably 5 or 6 years later for around that price. But that was a really interesting property in that it was in Montauk, you know, right on the ocean. Just, I mean, you could literally, you know, almost spit and hit the ocean. And it was on a, you know, a rock, not on sand. So it was a solid property and was just pretty amazing, you know, historically, and just, you know, that's really a one of a kind property. You know, there've been many of them, but that's really one that stands out to me.
Yeah. And part of it got into being a reserve.
Yeah. He gave away some of the property. Some of the other, the Seven Sisters properties out there, the Stanford White Houses, those were pretty interesting. I sold a couple of those, one to Julian Schnabel, and then one to the women who owned Interview magazine. So those were very interesting properties historically.
Dick Cavett had the one that burned down.
Yeah, Dick Cavett owned one of these that I sold. I think Tick Hall was the one. That was a different one he had. He actually had a couple of them.
You do know they had a common kitchen building when it was built. You know that?
I don't remember that, but I wouldn't doubt that.
It burned down early, so then the members of the association, as it was called.
The Warhol estate was actually, I think, built by the Arm & Hammer baking soda family, you know, as a fishing retreat out there. I think they were the original builders of that property.
What's becoming of Carl Fisher's home?
I don't know. You talking about the big apartment building there or his home?
It's a house that's currently occupied by the Historical Society. It's on...
Is that on Eastlake or something, or Westlake?
It's on South Fairview, I think on North Fairview.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that one.
What's the largest commercial project that you sold?
Watermill Lumber, the business and the real estate, right before the crash in 2007.
Anything you want to talk about, mention, as in, because there have always been things at the last minute to change things, and sometimes it's very dramatic. Have you ever experienced anything like that where something came apart and somebody else jumped on it?
Probably, but I can't think of anything off the top of my head. I mean, no, not off the top of my head. Just an interesting anecdote about, you know, when I first started working and was with Alan Schneider, the Juan Trip estate on West End was being sold to Calvin Klein for $6 million. And that was like a huge deal back then. That was probably in the mid 80s. And I mean, just to show you pricing, I think that sold a couple of years ago for $80 million. So that tells you something about pricing in the Hamptons. That was always part of the sales pitch. You know, prices never go down in the Hamptons. That was always part of your sales pitch. But you know, once the, you know, crash 2007, 2008, that ended that, because there was probably a 25, 30%, you know, reduction in pricing. And, you know, during that period, I don't think there was a commercial transaction for probably, you know, a year or two. You know, it was really, really devastating. And luckily, I had hit that big deal before that. So I was able to live off of that deal for probably over a year, year and a half, you know, because nothing else was trading.
Something else that I've noticed is often a seller will claim without attribution that somebody very important lived in the house years ago. And I've noticed that on several occasions. Marilyn Monroe was one of the examples about that.
That little windmill in Amagansett?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and she supposedly.
Well, she
I don't know if that has any, you know, effect on value. I mean, I had an interesting property on Windmill Lane in Amagansett. I don't know if you remember the case where I think it was a cross-dressing man killed his wife there and went to Connecticut or something. So they were trying to sell the house and, you know, different people had different reactions, you know, knowing somebody had been murdered in the house, you know. Some people were like, you know, completely turned off about it and it didn't bother others. And so it's, you never know. Everybody's different.
Yeah. I thought he lived on Skellinger by the tracks.
No, it was on Windmill, you know, but, you know, Skellinger comes into Windmill. It wasn't far from Skellinger Lane. It was right in that area, but it was on Windmill.
Anything else you want to chat about?
Not really. You know, I mean, just plug it away. I'm going to be a grandfather for the first time. So I know you're a grandfather. So I'm looking forward to that.
And much for the better, I think. And,
yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks for being on the podcast.
You're welcome, Dan. You're quite welcome, and anytime.
Okay, though. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.